This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington, filling in for Neil Conan. It seems nearly everywhere we turn these days, someone is trying to make a sale. On a rainy day, we're persuaded to buy an umbrella. At the mall, it's the latest perfume. Or at home, a phone call to ask if you're happy with your life insurance. The salesman pitch has become a familiar part of American life, but its relationship to American capitalism has often been overlooked and misunderstood. Many experts say the salesman not only fed American consumerism, he shaped it. Still, it's an occupation that always seems to get a bad rap. Are you a salesperson who thinks you don't deserve the bad reputation? Have you ever studied the art of the sale? Or have you been duped by a master? Join the conversation this hour. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email is totn@npr.org. Joining us is Walter Friedman, the author of a new book that traces the evolution of the American salesman and sales force. His book is called Birth of a Salesman, The Transformation of Selling in America. He's also a historian at Harvard Business School and joins us from WBUR in Boston. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thanks, Joe.
So let's take a look back and tell us something about the early days of salesmanship in America. It wasn't really the salesman as we think of him or her today.
Well, selling really went under a fundamental transition in American history. I mean, in the United States, it was not too much different from other European nations in its early history in that it had peddlers going farm to farm, selling pots and pans and other items. Selling was really an art, you know, that was left to the sort of inspired banter of individuals. But in America, by the mid-19th century, there's really an effort to make selling much more systematic, if not even a science. American companies really pioneer sales management. They start to launch organized sales campaigns, particularly in the years following the Civil War. Salesmen sell sewing machines, cash registers, adding machines, and later cars. I mean, these are really the goods that come to define the country's economy by their sort of early appearance and their widespread purchase. And by the early 20th century, the country has really been transformed from one that had a landscape of peddlers and these traveling canvassers to one with professional salespeople and large sales forces, networks of car dealerships, and even department store clerks. At this point, the country is really divided into sales territories. Sales managers draft these intricate sales scripts, which people go and follow when they go out and meet prospects. They advise book agents, for instance, never to give the prospect the book itself, but to just show them so that they're sort of selling a dream rather than the item itself.
These are scripts that the salesman kept with them or memorized and they read as if they were performing it?
That's right. That comes quite early, actually. I mean, one of the first really great sales campaigns is orchestrated by Mark Twain. And that's really an effort to sell the memoirs of Ulysses S. Grant. And what Twain and his associates do is they write a very intricate sales script which tells book canvassers exactly what to say, how to stand, how to enter and leave a house, even how to hold the book when you're talking to someone. It's all there in black and white.
Wow. But is this an example of trying to get people to buy something they don't really need? I mean, I don't know, perhaps everybody in the 19th century needed a life of Ulysses S. Grant or memoirs of Ulysses S. Grant, but they were prizing money from people for the copy of this book that they didn't really need.
Well, what they do is they make it very difficult to say no. I mean, this is the thing that salesmen learn how to do, particularly at this point. They're going to farmhouses where the farmers really don't have an awful lot of money. And what they do is they find ways to gain the trust of the farmer quite quickly. One of the things they do is they go first to sell it to leading people in the town. And then when they approach a farmer, they can say, well, look, this person bought it, your neighbor bought it, can't you afford it? Don't you have a child who needs a good education? They'll be left out if they don't have it. So they learn these ways to talk about the book in such a way that the farmer really feels pressured to buy it. Not only that, but they also have these kind of tricks and clever things that they do. I mean, for the sale of this particular item, Twain and his associates had all of the canvassers dress in their military uniforms, even if they had no military experience. But that way it sort of played upon the sympathy of the person, you know, that they would be buying into this history of the war effort and to Grant, and to Grant himself, who at this point had lost all of his money in bad investments.
Now, you mentioned that sales became more systematized and nationwide. Who was responsible for that? Was it an individual or a company, or how did that come to be?
Well, I think the most important person in the history of selling is probably John H. Patterson. Patterson he's the one who formed the National Cash Register Company. Patterson is born in the 1840s, and he grows up in Dayton, Ohio. Like a lot of other people at that time, he goes into the coal business, but he never really succeeds in it. And one day he happens upon this new invention, which is the cash register, and he decides that this is going to be the great thing. And he buys out the inventor, Joseph Ritty, and he gets the patent for it. But then he finds himself in an awful situation, and that nobody really seems to want it, because up till this point, storekeepers had always kept their money in a cash drawer, and they really didn't have any need for a register. So what Patterson does is he inundates shopkeepers with first advertising and then sales calls, and he starts to advertise the register as a thief catcher. He starts to say to them, look, you don't really know the people that are working for you, and they might be stealing from your cash drawer. You know, you need some way to check on that. Now, naturally, that causes some resentment amongst the people who are actually tilling the jar. But what he does is he just keeps pushing and pushing, and he builds what becomes the greatest sales force of the early 20th century. He divides the country up into territories and decides sort of arbitrarily that one register should be sold for every 400 people in a town. So it creates these quota systems. He then creates this primer, which divides the sales process into several steps. And he creates the first sort of modern sales conventions with large dinners and bands and all these sort of things. He really views selling as a science. I mean, Patterson, in a lot of ways, should get credit in the way that Ford gets credit for sort of inventing mass production, because Patterson really invents the sort of mass sales campaign.
And is this the first example of the sales driving the manufacturing rather than the other way around? Because surely they must have been selling these cash registers before they started investing in all the capital it took to make them.
It's absolutely the time when that starts. He's selling them before he actually makes them. That's right. And he's not only selling them in the U.S., but he starts exporting them. So the cash register is one of the first sort of mass manufacturing goods that shows up throughout the world that's made by the United States. The sewing machine precedes a little bit, but the cash register turns up all over. He's selling cash registers in South Africa. He's selling them throughout Europe. He's selling them certainly in England and Germany, where he establishes his own sort of manufacturing plants. But what's really, I think, interesting about Patterson is how far he takes this systematic approach. Everything is broken down. As I said, he breaks down the sales strategy into four parts. One is the approach in which you go to a merchant and you don't actually show him the register or even talk about it. You just tell him, you just sort of give him the fear that maybe he's losing money and he doesn't really know how to account for it. The next step is the proposition, where you actually introduce the register and tell him how it works. The third is the demonstration, where you invite him to your hotel room and actually show him how the machine operates and go through how the buttons work and go through all the drawers. And the last step is the most important. It's the close. And that's where you're supposed to wait for that psychological moment when you think the guy's ready to buy, and then make it very natural and easy for him to actually buy this thing. And so Patterson really, really invents this process, and he creates an entire sales school to sell it. He creates a little red schoolhouse, actually, in which he has cash register salesmen teach other salesmen what they do.
Wow. So it was really, I mean, it was a serious scholarly endeavor, totally turned to turning a profit.
Yeah, and it's quite successful. I mean, Patterson, he's very aggressive. And one of the things that's amazing about NCR in this period is the number of people who pass through it. I mean, Richard H. Grant is one of the people who works at NCR. He later goes on to head Chevrolet, and then he institutes some of Patterson's strategies in beating Ford, and that's sort of how Chevrolet becomes as popular as it does. But his most important alumnus is Thomas Watson of IBM. Watson really follows Patterson's methods, and he kind of refines them, and he builds what, you know, later becomes the most famous sales force, you know, the blue-suited IBM salespeople who are sort of renowned for their uniformity of approach.
We're talking about the birth of salesmanship, and you're welcome to join the conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And let's go to one of the people who've called in. Is it Kai in Columbus, Ohio?
That's correct. Thank you very much. Excellent show, as always. I'm coming at this from a couple of different angles. And I just want to sort of throw this out there as an observation. I'm a professor at a university, and with the increasing sort of corporatization of our academic systems, particularly in higher education, people who normally were not in positions of having to be salespeople, i.e. professors and researchers, have sort of been, you know, I think facing increasing pressures to do exactly that, which is to become salespeople as opposed to sort of, you know, purely immersed in one's ideas or one's work. And I was wondering if there's any observation into how the sort of larger environment or milieu of, you know, pushing sales has affected non-traditional areas where sales were not necessarily, you know, a part of the work environment or expectation. And the other question that I have is related to the idea of ethics and salesmanship or, you know, salespersonship we've seen particularly in terms of, you know, again, increased corporatization, increased globalization, that at times ethics are sacrificed to get a certain quota or to get a certain, you know, profit margin achieved. And, you know, my experience has not been at that level, but perhaps even things like, you know, where car dealerships get their sort of, you know, bad name. And I've certainly had those experiences where sort of ethics be damned, but salesmanship be sort of glorified at any cost. And I just wanted to hear your observations on those two points.
Interesting points. Dr. Friedman, what do you think?
Well, on the first point, it's interesting to me. When I first got into this subject, I was interested in the sort of negative reaction that people have to salesmen and salespeople. And I started to trace this in fiction because it struck me that the salesman has always been this figure in fiction, even from Yankee folk tales about peddlers through the writings of Melville and Twain, all the way up through Babbitt and Willie Loman. And one of the things that I realized is that the sort of negative image of salesmen changes over time. In the sort of early period, salesmen are regarded as these tricksters who kind of show up in town, and there's these marginal figures who get somebody to buy something. They swindle something. And that's really what they're about. They're not really the sort of key mainstream people that we, you know, that we're writing about. But later, with this, after the sort of growth of mass production, you have books like Babbitt. And the message there is that everybody's a salesman. The salesman has now become the central figure, which sort of sums up what America's about and what everybody does. And I think that this feeling is that it just, by the 20th century, salesmanship inundates everything. And we see it again with Willie Loman. And I think that feeling he has is part of that growing salesmanship taking over every aspect of life.
We're talking about the rise and development of the American salesman, and we're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington. We're talking with Walter Friedman, historian at Harvard Business School and author of the new book, Birth of a Salesman, The Transformation of Selling in America. And we're talking about the changing image of the American salesman. Have you ever tried to perfect the art of the sale? Have you ever worked in a company where the sales force rules? You're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. For decades, car salesmen have been the punchline of jokes about the shadier side of sales. In a 2003 Gallup poll of honesty and ethics in professions, car salesmen ranked among the lowest. And we don't want to ask the question where journalists ranked, because that's a different show topic. But is this ranking deserved? How many of us really understand what happens behind the dealership doors? Phil Reed spent 3 months undercover as a car salesman to research the book Strategies for Smart Car Buyers. He's also on the consumer advice editor at the online automotive resource Edmunds.com. He joins us from KPCC in Pasadena, California. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Now, you say you used to hate and fear car salesmen and women and lump them into all the same generalizations. Did you change your view after the experience?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I was working on the other side of the desk, essentially, and I developed an enormous sympathy for how difficult that job is, and also the fact that they all know that we hate them, you know, and so they're dealing in a job they're working every day, knowing that they're dealing with customers that don't really want to talk to them, but they have the cars, and so they have to deal with them. So I think that the other thing that changed in my perspective was that I really began to admire the good car salesmen, of which there are quite a few. But to continue to fear the bad ones.
Huh. Well, we have a car salesman on the line, Joe in Cleveland. Go ahead. What's your sense of a car salesman today?
Well, I sold Toyotas for 5 years, and I loved every aspect of it, except for the aspect that the customers came in, and right off the bat, they didn't like us because of the stereotypes, and I'm a nice guy, and I always treated my customers with, the utmost respect and honesty, and, we were just trying to get, the manufacturer's suggested price for the vehicle, not trying to pull anyone over on anybody, but, every time you present numbers to people, they just always felt, you're being shady.
So, Joe, let me ask you a question. Did you make a good living as a car salesman?
I made an excellent living.
So you were good at it?
Yeah.
So here's the question.
I worked my way up, through finance and desk manager and everything.
So, Phil Reed, from your perspective, as someone who's looked at this profession, can you be a good, honest, successful car salesman?
Yeah, without a doubt. I was just going to throw out something in reaction to that comment that when I was selling cars, the car salesman had a saying there where they would say, buyers are liars. They were very well aware that the consumer felt that they were ripping them off, but the consumers would come in with false information. They would come in with all sorts of excuses. They wanted to test drive the car, but then they had to leave because their son had a doctor's appointment, all these kinds of things. So, after they did leave, then the car salesman would hang around grumbling.
I read your article.
Buyers are liars.
Uh-huh. Joe, go ahead. What were you saying?
Was it fair? I hope.
I read your article in Edmunds, and I was totally against Edmunds because I thought that they put out some misinformation. But after reading your article, you really lightened up. If consumers read your article, I think they would feel more comfortable going into the dealership.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that. And I have heard from a number of dealerships, one down in Florida, said that they actually use my piece as a training tool for their salesmen, basically with the idea of broadening perspective and how not to do it.
Right.
And but then I never did answer the question, which is, can you be honest and do a good job selling cars? Without a doubt. And I think that, I've met so many. I actually buy cars for Edmunds now that I'm working there full time. And I, of course, only deal with the really good car salesmen, and when I do deal with them, it's such a joy because it facilitates the whole transaction. The product knowledge, has to be solid. They know how to streamline the process and bring the car to you, and it's a joy. So there's definitely is a good place for the good car salesman.
Joe, thanks very much for your call.
Thank you.
But, Phil, let me ask you, if I may, this question.
Sure.
So here you are. The issue with salesmen is it seems to be, as Joe just brought up, there's this mythical number called the manufacturer's suggested retail
right.
price, which seems, as far as I can tell, to be a number that's made up in Disneyland someplace and stamped on the car window for people. I mean, if you went into a grocery store and said, you know, $1.89 for bananas or something like that,
right.
and that turned out to be not even a nodding acquaintance with the actual price, you'd begin to feel like something was shady was going on. And yet this is standard operating procedure in the car business. So yep. Doesn't that make the sales process inherently somewhat, you start off with this sort of funny premise?
Well, that's a very interesting point you bring up. I mean, the sticker price, which is MSRP, is sort of the beginning price of most negotiations in car sales. The car salesman would like you to pay sticker price, but it's widely known that if you dicker, haggle, whatever, you can get them down. Now, where do you get them to? That's the big question, and that's what the negotiation process is about. You start low, they start high, and someplace in the middle you meet. The difficulty for the salesman is that he wants to retain your friendship, your trust, and all these things while you're going through essentially a confrontational process, and that's what's so difficult about it. But, you know, believe me, the MSRPs are not made in Disneyland. You know, those are highly researched figures, and they're trying to, you know, hit it right on the head. And then when they don't, you know, there's the incentives, the rebates. So the classic is it's a little bit like the grocery business where they raise the price but then immediately put it on sale. And the American attitude towards pricing is you offer it at a fairly high price but immediately discount it through rebates and incentives.
Did for a long time, or for a while anyway, I recall that one car company, I think was it Saturn, they just said, here's the price. You come in, you pay it. We don't.
Oh, they still do that. Yeah, that's the no-haggle pricing.
And is that working? Has that put salesmen out of business,
well,
or are
I
they
can...
still selling?
Yeah, no. Well, there's. It's funny because, you know, the salesman fulfills a very different purpose in that particular transaction, where basically what you're doing is presenting the product to the consumer. The price is known from the beginning up front, and that's not going to change. So there's. It's a completely different dynamic. You can, in that particular case, facilitate and assist the customer in terms of making the right choice without fear that you're going to alienate them when the subject of price comes up.
Interesting.
It's been very effective for them, and it's won them a lot of repeat customers, I can tell you. Now, there are other car lots which are experimenting with the same thing. I think CarMax does sort of a no-haggle pricing. And you can go on to a lot of car lots across the country, and they'll say, you know, here's your no-haggle price. The big question is it no-haggle or not?
Right.
Or if you start to, you know, if you approach them the right way, can you get a discount?
Right. I wonder, has the Internet, they supposedly have Internet prices now, which are no-haggle.
Well, Internet... The Internet has changed car buying enormously, largely because it's made the whole process a lot more transparent. The big number that you can get on the Internet is the invoice price. Now, the invoice is roughly what the dealer paid for the car. So if you look at that price at a profit, how much you believe is fair, then you've got the price that you'd like to close the transaction at. Meanwhile, the car salesman is probably somewhere up around sticker price.
Right. Well, Phil Reed, thanks very much for talking with us about this this
My
topic.
Pleasure.
It's very interesting. Phil Reed is the author of a new book, Strategies for Smart Car Buying. He's also the advice editor at the online automotive resource, Edmunds.com. He joined us from KPCC in Pasadena, California. And still with us is Walter Friedman, a historian at Harvard Business School and author of the new book, Birth of a Salesman, The Transformation of Selling in America. And we're taking your calls at 800-989-8255. Let's go to caller number one, Ed in Oklahoma City. You're on the line.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Pretty good.
Great. My question is this. You know, I'm a salesman, and I've been in sales for over 20 years now, but when I entered sales, I had no intention of going into sales, and most people that I work with, if not all, seem to fall into the sales profession and are trained then by the companies they work for. You know, since it is a very profitable career, why is it that you're not seeing more colleges, universities, high schools even teaching it as a curriculum?
Professor Friedman, is Harvard going to pick up that topic as one of the freshman courses?
Well, let's hope so. But no, they don't teach salesmanship very often. I mean, salesmanship is actually really taught in popular books and things like that, and how to succeed books. It really hasn't caught on at all. I mean, and part of it is the stigma attached with being a salesperson. I mean, you mentioned that Gallup poll, but the truth is that there's other polls that suggest mothers and fathers just discourage their children from going into selling at all. The salesman really does have a negative image. And in relation to some of the things that we just heard from Phil Reed, the case is that selling is very difficult, and that most of the people who try selling get discouraged and then try something else. I mean, the turnover at most on most sales forces is incredibly high. In particular, at places like Fuller Brush, they would have sales turnovers more than 100% a year. So they just have to keep getting a whole new sales force over and over. And one of the real efforts for these companies is to try to find a way to keep salesmen optimistic or encouraged. And that's what a lot of sales management becomes, not just getting them to be better salespeople, but getting them to feel okay about the constant failure. I mean, Fuller, for instance, introduced this club, which sounds kind of strange, but it was this sort of fine and dandy club in the 1920s. And the point of it was that no matter how bad your day was going, no matter what was going wrong, you were supposed to say you were fine and dandy. And you're supposed to say it even at the start of all your sales calls. Hi, I'm so-and-so. I'm fine and dandy. How are you? And it's crazy, but that club really caught on. And what they tried to do with that was just to get the feeling that things were okay, and it became this kind of phenomenon within Fuller. But that effort of motivating salesmen, getting them to feel that what they do is legitimate and what they do is good, and that they can withstand a door slammed in their face is a real challenge.
Ed, thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Ted in Palo Alto, California. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes. Can I make a comment?
Oh, yes, please. What would you like to talk about? We're talking about sales right now. I think that would be a good place to start.
I'm a professional salesman. I've been selling for about 20 years in the Silicon Valley area for a couple of well-known software firms. And I've had a debate like this similar to my cousin who's a carpenter, who talks about the inherent manipulative aspects of selling. What I get a kick out of is the level that I sell at, business to business and million-dollar items, there really is no opportunity to lie or misrepresent your product, or very little. Companies are extremely thorough in their evaluation. I have to fill out RFPs, or requests for proposal often. The terms of the purchase are written into the contract. My competitor forces me to stay honest. It's really the kiss of death if you had come in any sense, had tried to manipulate the sales process or misrepresented your product. And it's just I'm just surprised that that's not really well understood, at least on these high-end items. It's just, even if I wanted to, I don't have an opportunity to be able to manipulate the process. It's just most of the time I'm a conveyor of information, and I have to bring together a team that's able to see if we can win the sale.
What about that, Professor Friedman?
Well, there's really two different types of selling, as far as I can tell. And one is really transaction-oriented, which is the sort of quick sell. You know, even the car, you can look at that way. But a better example are these sort of door-to-door people or somebody who just has one-off item to sell you. And that's a whole different story than somebody who has what I would call a relationship-oriented selling, which is when you have a client that you want to keep for year after year. And the incentives in each case is quite different. I mean, as you can imagine, in the first one, you really know you're only going to see this person once or twice. And so you really have to establish trust very quickly and then try to close the sale. Whereas if you're going to have a long-term relationship with somebody, you might not even try to sell them the first few times you meet them, or maybe even the first few months or so. Sometimes the sales relationships go on for years, particularly in cases of business-to-business selling and in the financial services. I mean, those deals that the salesmen and saleswomen structure, can take an awful long time to set up. So the incentives are quite different. So, in a case like that, you really do have to establish trust on a real basis. In other words, you really can't sort of hype up the product too much because you will be found out.
We're talking about sales and salesmanship. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Ted, if you can stay on the line for a second, there was a part of Walter Friedman's book that I wanted to ask you about, and then I'll ask Professor Friedman, and that is when you've got two products that are fairly similarly matched, a sales force is really going to be the thing that pushes one over the top. And I think Professor Freeman made the example of Microsoft operating system products, where they didn't necessarily have the slam dunk best product, but they had such an extended and effective sales force that they essentially took over the market. Is that your observation? Can you make inroads with a very effective sales force?
Yes. No question. I think the law of capitalism is that the market's going to get to a point it's going to commoditize any offering. So the differences between the products I've represented before are very, very subtle. I think in a case that most people are probably familiar with is, I think you'd be hard-pressed really to point out the difference between a Toyota and a Honda. And the way in which I've seen people work with it, develop the relationship with the customer, do a lot of needs analysis, emphasize the benefits that your product offers, and then minimize the drawbacks on it. That's where it really comes down to being a salesperson.
Okay.
I like to say that what I really do is influence perception.
Right.
Rather than, that's the major thing that I do.
Ted, thanks for your thoughts on that. What about that, Professor Freeman? Where does sales pick up, or advertising end and sales start, and vice versa?
I think this is what salesmen are particularly great at, is when you have two products that are similar, and the salesman can really push the prospect or the buyer to one or the other. I mean, this was the case with vacuums when salesmen used to show up door to door. They would really target the competing company, whether it was Hoover or Electrolux. Same with the cars. I mean, as I mentioned with Chevrolet and Ford, Chevrolet dealers were trained to point out all of the things that they didn't like about Fords, or all the things that they thought that were problems with Fords. And again, Xerox does the same thing, and Microsoft does the same thing. IBM also with other computer companies. The strong sales force, when items are similar or they're complicated, the salesperson can really explain them in such a way, or get you to see them in such a way that it can push your decision from one to the other. And it's quite an important thing, because as in the case with Chevrolet, I mean, the idea was, if you're going to get them to buy the Chevrolet once, they're going to buy it again. So as far as the Chevrolet salesperson was concerned, if you could just push them to get the Chevrolet or to try it once, you'd probably have that customer for a long time. And so it really, really was important for them to be able to point out these very small differences between similar items.
Interesting. Well, I'm afraid that's where we have to leave it. Walter Freeman is a historian at Harvard Business School. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
He joined us from member station WBUR in Boston. He's the author of the new book, Birth of a Salesman, The Transformation of Selling in America. When we come back from a short break, The Life of a Candy Freak. How much candy can one person have in the house at one time? Oh, there's a question to contemplate. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.